From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. The world lost another beloved figure on April the 21st, Prince. On today's show, we're paying tribute to him by rebroadcasting some of my favorite conversations with him.
When you don't talk down to your audience, then they can grow with you. And I give them a lot of credit to be able to hang with me this long because I've gone through a lot of changes. But they've allowed me to grow, and we can tackle some serious subjects.
Prince was one of the most talented musicians of his generation. He was also one of the world's most charismatic and private stars. Today, we'll hear two conversations in which he reflected on his prolific music career and talked about his life's philosophy. Today, on the Tavis Smiley Show from PRI, after the news. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, we're paying tribute to the legendary music icon Prince. He passed away unexpectedly at the age of 57 last week. News of his death shocked the world, and the immediate reaction was huge. Public figures and fans shared their grief on social media. International landmarks from Niagara Falls to the Eiffel Tower in France were lit purple to honor Prince's life and legacy. Born Prince Rogers Nelson, he exploded onto the music scene in the 1970s. A virtuoso on guitars, keyboard, and drums, he was one of the very few musicians who could write and produce all of his music and, on some albums, play all the instruments. With a career spanning more than 35 years, Prince won 7 Grammy Awards, an Oscar for the original song score to the film Purple Rain, and was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2004, the first year he was eligible, not to mention numerous top 10 hits for himself and for other artists. Given such accomplishment, you can imagine the difficulty finding a succinct way to introduce him the very first time he appeared on this program. He joined us just days after his electrifying performance with Beyoncé at the 46th Annual Grammy Awards and shared his thoughts on their performance and, well, my introduction as well. The artist formerly known and now known once again as Prince. That's the best I can come up with.
Lord have mercy. That's it, huh?
That's all I can come up with.
All right.
Because otherwise, it would have taken me 20 minutes. It would have taken me the whole show to introduce you because you are so phenomenal. So thanks for coming to see me. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Let me start with this Grammy thing. First of all, you rocked the Grammys.
Yeah.
That was an amazing performance. Did you enjoy it?
Loved it.
I was scared when I heard that you were going to do this thing with Beyoncé. Mm-hmm. And I was scared, as I told you, because you were such all that by yourself. I was afraid that it wasn't going to come off right. Even though I love Beyoncé, she's very talented. I was just afraid that Prince can't do nothing with nobody else. He got to do his thing because he's Prince. But it came off okay.
Oh, I pride myself on working with great musicians, and I consider her to be as such. She's an amazing talent. She's a real deal. Yeah. So she just fell right into it. There was no problem whatsoever.
How did that performance come about? I mean, you decided to do whatever you want to do on your own terms, but how did that actually come to be?
Well, the producer, Ken Ehrlich, had been hounding me every year to do something. And this year we have a new record coming out, so and a tour scheduled. So I thought if this was going to be the year, then I wanted to do something special. Then the notion of working with Beyoncé came about, and that made it extra special because I'm such a fan. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's nice for Prince to be a fan of your stuff. Yeah. Speaking of being a fan, as you well know, and I can't even hide it, I'm a fan of your stuff. And I guess a couple weeks ago, I went to Vegas to see you, not in one show, but 2 shows. And you got to stop doing these things at 2 and 3 in the morning because I can't stay up 2 days in a row.
Well, see, that's how I tell who's real and who ain't.
Am I authentic now?
Yeah, you
are. Am I real now?
Yeah, that's why I'm here.
I'm glad to hear that, then. All right. So if I can stay up at 2 and 3 in the morning, yeah, just not to see you go off stage. I mean, coming on at 2 a.m., coming on at 3 a.m., right, and playing to 5, 6 o'clock in the morning. But I stood and watched that audience in Vegas, Prince, and there are 2 or 3 things that stand out to me about your audience in particular. One, you have the absolute most diverse audience of any artist, no pun intended, that I've ever hung out with or experienced in concert consistently. What is it about you or about your music? I mean, I've seen the black thing and the white thing and the Motown thing had the black folk and the white folk listening, but you have the most ethnically, culturally, racially diverse audience, I think, of any artist on the scene. Why you?
I think from the beginning, as I was coming into my own persona and understanding of who I was, I never talked down to my audience. Mm-hmm. And when you don't talk down to your audience, then they can grow with you. And I give them a lot of credit to be able to hang with me this long, because I've gone through a lot of changes. But they've allowed me to grow, and thus we can tackle some serious subjects and try to just be better human beings, mm-hmm. all of us, you know.
The other thing that strikes me about your audience that's uniquely different is that your audience is very musically sophisticated. It's one thing mm-hmm. to love music. Mm-hmm. It's another thing to have an audience of fans that is really very sophisticated about music.
Yeah, a lot of the people that come see us now, their parents listen to real music, mm-hmm. real songwriting, real musicianship, and they respect somebody who takes their craft seriously. And I grew up that way, so when we do our shows, I try to have the best musicians I can find mm-hmm. with me at that particular time. And like I said, we don't play down to them. We don't, we're just not, it's just not about a party, you know. That's gonna be anyway, if it's good music. Mm-hmm. But, you have to challenge them. And I think that's lacking in music mm-hmm. today.
You have changed, as you said a moment ago, and evolved in so many ways, and have gone through so many stages in your own career development. You said a moment ago that because of that, you like to do different things. It's very difficult oftentimes for a performer, for an artist, to hang on to his or her audience when they're not doing the stuff that you know they want to hear. Mm-hmm. And you have a certain, and I say this with all respect, there's a certain arrogance about you that will come out on stage, and you know these folks done paid their money, and you know they want to hear Lil Red Corvette, you know they want to hear Delirious, you know they want to hear Purple Rain, 1999, everything else, but you come out and play what you want to play at that particular stage in your life, and for your true core fans, they don't ever leave disappointed.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I don't know who was the one that came up with the notion that you have to play the same songs every concert.
Probably fans.
Yeah. Well, most of the people that come see us now, they've been to see me umpteen times. And the only pity is when they bring their kids and they're trying to show their kids the experience they had. But I don't know how any of us grow if we just, you know, tread water. Mm-hmm. The idea is that we keep growing, and like we were saying before, is the fan base I have now, they're so sophisticated, they almost expect me to do the unexpected. Mm-hmm. And that gives me a lot of room to challenge myself as well as them. Mm-hmm.
One of the things I've been dying to ask you about is this notion of whether or not you think too many performers, too many artists have become too racy and become so willing to sell a record that they will do just about anything to make that record sell. And I want to ask you that question specifically because you are the king, okay, the prince of raciness. Because back in the day, you were like, you were, I can't even call it pushing the envelope. You were really pushing the envelope back in the day. So what's your sense now of artists who've gotten in trouble of late pushing the envelope and being extremely racy for much of the American audience?
Well, you know, everything's relative. First of all, racy back when I was quote-unquote racy, as you say, I mean, it's pretty light now. I mean, if you take the words to Darling Nikki, which I got into a little bit of hot water about back in 84, if you take those lyrics and read them now, it's a little different than, say, the president of the RIAA reading the lyrics to one of these current hip-hop songs at a congressional hearing.
Yeah.
You know, it's a lot different now. Anytime you have to rely on just raciness alone, you know, you can only, put it this way, you're gonna get the audience you deserve. Mm. All right, so when we were wearing more risque outfits, we had a bunch of
risque fans.
That's right, in the audience.
Yeah.
And you know, when you're 21 years old, you're gonna try stuff. When you're 40, it's, you know, You don't want to be pulling out body parts because it just, it's old skin.
It's old skin, yeah.
So it's different then, you know. You don't want to be showing all that then.
Yeah. But we live in a world now, we live in a culture where artists and media conglomerates sell us. I just reading an article the other day in the LA Times about this very issue, that we get sold all this hype. All this hype gets pushed on us, and they're really selling events that really turn out to be non-events oftentimes.
Mm. Well, once again, they will get the audience and the consumer that they deserve. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a glut in the industry because of this thinking. You know, it's all bottom line. It's all real quick. The artist turnover rate is really fast, and it's not a lot of substance. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of these kids don't know how to play music because they didn't learn it. They weren't taught the art and the craft of songwriting, and it is an art. And if you don't respect that, then you know, we're going to get a lot of these non-events going on.
I'm glad, but more importantly, the people who get a chance to play and work with you, I'm sure are glad that over the years, speaking of playing instruments, that you got to be a little bit nicer and let somebody play on your record. Because when you first broke, all songs written, produced, performed, lead vocals, background vocals, everything on the album was done by you.
Yeah. Well, there again, it's a situation where, you know, where people, if they want me to go back and do what I used to do, they have to understand that it's my body of work, mm-hmm. and I'm trying to put in that body of work things that I haven't done, so that when I finish and I look at all of it, it represents, you know, mm-hmm. the whole complete pie as opposed to the same thing over and over.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Prince was well known for his electrifying performances, but few knew about his commitment to helping social justice causes. More now of my 2004 conversation with Prince, who died unexpectedly at his Paisley Park home last week. Who's running the business now? There's a big debate now with what just happened to L.A. Reid at Arista. Had more Grammy nominations on Grammy night than any other record label.
Right.
And they kicked him out of the building in New York with the quickness.
Right. Can I at least go to the Grammys? can I just?
Yeah, well, it was nice that Outkast brought him up on stage. I mean, that was nice. They gave him some love. But the question is, who's running the business now? Are the creatives running it? Are the suits running it? What's the state of the business these days?
Well, that changed a long time ago when it became merely bottom line. You'll see, if you go back and you look at music, you'll see a big change when MTV came into the business. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not to say that they're running it, but that sort of mentality is what is king now. It's not about content and substance. You know, hip-hop is very diverse, but if you only focus on one aspect of it, mm-hmm. then what you get is this image of Black America that is completely contrary to what actually goes on, mm-hmm. you know. I've never seen you in a jogging suit, you know. You fit and trim, but look at how you're dressed. The gatekeepers, they know who they are. We don't need to name names, but rest assured, they aren't musicians. Mm-hmm. They don't have anything to do with music. If you sit one of them in the room and you ask them, what is it that you do? How did you get this job? A lot of them came from law. A lot of them came from accounting and things like that. They're merchants, basically. Mm-hmm. And it's not to disrespect them or demean their role in any way, but at the same time, you can't expect them to know who they're signing and sort of gatekeep the music.
Let me change gears on you dramatically, because I've been dying to show this to you. I don't know if you've seen this or not. Maybe you have, but if you haven't, I want to show this to you. I went to see a movie the other day, and there was a clip in the movie that was absolutely hilarious, and I want you to see this, and I want to ask you something about it. Roll this clip for me.
With all the problems we got, Black folks used to could say, at least we ain't crazy. Our crimes made sense.
Ain't got no money,
Rob somebody with some money. Simple as that.
Hey, y'all don't want to admit it, but black folks just as crazy as white folks. Mike Tyson, he's like three crazy people, man.
Mike sure is.
Prince,
crazy.
Hold on now. He had Cherokee or something. Don't put him in there with us.
Prince is half Cherokee. Don't put him in there with us. Did you see this?
Yeah.
Did you laugh at this?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. There's a dispute over who my grandfather was on my mother's side.
So, right. Yeah. I don't know this even matters to you, but let me ask anyway. What's your sense of how the public has viewed you as a personality over the years and how that has changed? I mean, do you concern yourself with that? Are you conscious of how you have been viewed over the course of your career? Does it matter to you? What do you think about what people think of you, if you think about that at all?
That's kind of a deep question.
I get one every now and then.
Yeah. I'm sort of like a, because of some of the stances that I take, mm-hmm. people are gonna have different viewpoints of me depending upon which side of the fence they're sitting on. Mm-hmm. Like we were talking about the music industry, a merchant would have trouble being called a bean counter when in fact they know that's true. Mm-hmm. They'd be hard pressed though to try to sing a song with me. So I don't really care so much what people say about me because it usually is a reflection of who they are. For example, if people wish I would sound like I used to sound, then it says more about them than it does me. If I change the lyrics to a song, then it begs the question, why do you want me to curse? Why do you want me to talk like other people? See, cursing was cool when nobody was doing it, but just a couple people.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah, like if everybody wears the same clothes,
right.
Then it's, it ain't cool no more. You know, you're trying to be different. One can't be different by being racy today. It's not interesting anymore. See, sexiness was in the mind. It was in your imagination. When you lose that, then, like I said, it's just old skin.
Yeah. We've had a number of conversations over the years off camera, obviously, and you are a very, very politically astute, very much politically aware, a news junkie. And I've often wondered why it is that as interested as you are in the world that we live, and with all this happening in the world, what your thoughts are specifically in this election year, economically, politically, socially. I'm asking a broad question to give you room to play with here, but tell me something about your political views in this particular and all-important election year.
Oh, first of all, I think just the word political and politics and all that is just semantics. Mm-hmm. An equal share of economic wherewithal is desirable by all. I mean, we all just want to take care of our families and do it to the best of our abilities and see the world. People want to travel and things like that. A lot of people that I know haven't even been out of the United States. So I consider myself more of a spiritual person than I do political. I'm more concerned with the truth, more concerned with why people won't adhere to it and why they see themselves as us against them. I used to think that we were the ones that came up with that, but see, we didn't start a lot of these wars, mm-hmm. and we certainly don't want to go to them.
Yeah. A lot has been written, and I shouldn't even say written, but there's been a lot of conjecture, a lot of conversation in the country about your spiritual evolution of late. Curious anything about that? Your spiritual journey?
Yeah, I'd say a big change happened for me in the year 2000 because I went back to using my name again.
And thank you for that, because it's hard trying to say what that symbol was.
Yeah, well, there was a purpose for that. And right. Recently, Anita Baker called me, and we spoke about her view of me writing slave on my face at the time. She said she didn't understand it at the time, but right after that, she had a lot of wars with her particular record company. And she's free now, and she owns her masters now. Mm-hmm. So she says to me, you know, I didn't understand it then, but I do now. Mm-hmm. I get it. Like I said, in year 2000, once I changed my name back and the war was finished with my so-called enemies, I started reading the Bible intensely, and I come to find out that this is the truth.
Yeah. Well, by any name, you a bad man.
All right.
And I thank you for coming to see me. And you got to come back and do this again.
Yes, sir.
You got a lot to say, and you got to come say it more regularly.
Definitely.
All right. I'm gonna hold you to that.
All right.
To close out, here's Prince and the very talented Wendy Melvoin performing "Reflection."
2 sevens together, like dumb and deafening. Try to catch the glass before it falls. Without a frown, can you turn up the stereo? I wanna play this old song, it's about love. Can I do that? Did we remember to water the plants today? I forgot to look up at the moon because I was too busy. Yes, I was too busy. Nice to know that when bodies wear out, we can get another. What does that one thing have to do with the other one? I don't know. I was just thinking about my mother. Turn the stereo back down. Ain't nothing worse than a one-night love song. Do you like my hair this way? Remember all the way back in the day when we would compare whose afro was the roundest? Mirror tiles above the bed, fishing nets and posters all over the walls, oh yeah. Sometimes I just wanna go out,
you know what I mean,
play my guitar, just watch all the cars go by.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. In this second half of our special tribute to Prince, you'll hear more of his insights on the music industry, his career, and his life. For the book, the best-selling book, mm-hmm. 21 Nights, mm-hmm. your photographer Randy was here. Randy St. Nicholas.
Yeah,
Randy was here. And I remember in that conversation, the two of us talking about the fact that you stay pretty much clean all the time. It's not like when you're in your house, you got on sweats and...
Randy said that?
Yeah, Randy said he's pretty sharp all the time.
Okay.
Yeah. No. That's not true?
Yeah, I sleep like this.
Yeah. Yeah, you know what? I would believe that except for the fact that I know that you don't sleep.
Yeah.
You really don't sleep very much.
I saw a sign in the back said, journalist, advocate, insomniac.
Yeah. Yeah, well, for you it should be the world's greatest musician, insomniac. That's what it is.
Props to you on your show. Seriously, I watch every chance I get, and man, it's just so enlightening.
Well, I appreciate
inspiring.
I'm glad you said that because I was actually
I never told you this story, but one day when you were on before, around town somewhere, and we had promoted that you were coming on, I walked past a group of people, and they didn't see me, obviously. And I overheard them talking about you and the fact you were going to be on my show the next night. And one of them said, why would Prince go on PBS? And I was thinking, they don't know that Prince watches, like, everything, but indeed watches PBS.
Well, I keep an eye on you because, you know, you have been an advocate, and I learned a lot from the State of the Black Union. You've sent it to me, and I make a point to try to check it out when I can. And
back to this PBS thing there right quick. I'll come back to that only because you really got into Unforgivable Blackness.
Yeah.
What'd you make of that PBS series?
Oh, it's amazing. I'm in sort of celebration mode right now. I'm just thankful to be alive. I'm thankful to have the friends that I do and the teachers that I do. And I've spent the last year just playing when I feel like it. And I really look forward to this time in my life. And I happened to come across that show, Unforgivable Blackness, and the story of Jack Johnson just moved me to no end. One of the reasons is that he had to deal with seemingly insurmountable odds all the time. You know, if he would knock somebody down, people from the audience would get into the ring and pick him back up, you know, so they could continue fighting.
Yeah.
And I just related to it on a lot of different ways. I've never spoken about this before, but I was born epileptic. And I used to have seizures when I was young. And my mother and father didn't know what to do or how to handle it, but they did the best they could with what little they had. And my mother told me one day I walked into her and said, Mom, I'm not gonna be sick anymore. And she said, why? And I said, because an angel told me so. Now, I don't remember saying it. That's just what she told me. And from that point on, I've been having to deal with a lot of things, getting teased a lot in school. And, you know, early in my career, I tried to compensate for that by being as flashy as I could and as noisy as I could. And, you know, I just looked, again, I look forward to this time in my life when I could reflect back on it and talk to people like yourself, Dr. Cornel West. I mean, when you all come over to the house and we sit and we just talk about heavy things, I just become thankful. I don't know what else to say other than that.
How did you get beyond, because I know you have so many fans of all ages, and I think there are no doubt some young people watching who will be helped by your answer to this question. As a kid, being teased so much, and kids get teased for all variety of reasons, as we know, how did you grow out of that into, not just into confidence, but indeed into excellence? Or maybe I'll put it in the wrong order, excellence and confidence. But how did you grow out of that? How did you navigate yourself past that?
Good question. The first thing I did is I went into self, and I taught myself music. My father left his piano at the house when he left, and I wasn't allowed to play it when he was there because I wasn't as good as him. So when he left, I was determined to get as good as him, and I taught myself how to play music, and I just stuck with it, and I did it all the time. And sooner or later, people in the neighborhood heard about me, and then they started to talk about me. And it wasn't in a teasing fashion, it was more like, wow, look what he can do. And there's something about having people around you giving you support that is it's motivating. And once I got that support from people, then I believed I could do anything. And I had a lot of really good teachers. My best friend, Andre Simone, his brother, Eddie, I'm entirely indebted to in this regard. He used to tell me, man, your songs are better than anybody's on the radio. You can do whatever you want to do. And I just kept rolling with it. Eventually, I went out to New York, and I got turned down my first time, but I just wasn't going to be put down, you know, so.
Back to this excellence thing, though. Talk to me about excellence. I mean, it's clear that you are head and shoulders above pretty much everybody else in the world of music. And that's my assessment, and a whole lot of fans agree. We all say amen? Amen. See that? So it's pretty clear you're head and shoulders above everybody else. But talk to me about how we, who are not Prince, can aspire to the level of excellence that you portray in what we do every day.
Well, everybody's talented at something.
Right.
And that's what makes the world go around. We all need each other. And again, it's about good mentoring and good teachers. I had a lot of good people around. The other thing I have to point out, though, is that how can I put this? My father was so hard on me. I was never good enough. And there was something about that, it was almost like the army when it came to music. Mm-hmm. It's like, that's not even close to, he'd say, it's not even close to what I'm doing. And he'd play again. And I could hear it. John Blackwell, my drummer, he's same way. His father taught him the same way. We learn like that. We learn from being shown. It doesn't come from books and just reading it. We need to be shown, you know? So it's just having really good teachers and a bar that's so high, you know, Tiger Woods. I mean, we can go on and on and on.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to juxtapose, knowing you as I do, everything about you is love. You create love in the space that you occupy. When folk come into your world, they feel the love. Love is in your lyrical content. Your whole life is about a love of humanity. I'm trying to juxtapose how you got to this place of being love when you have this relationship with your father that obviously didn't always exhibit love. You could be a very mean person now. Why not?
Well, I have a mean side.
Yeah. Let me back up there.
Yeah. I can go there.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a fighter. I'm very competitive. I think from him being so hard on me that the one thing I got out of it is I understood that in his harshness, he wanted me to excel. Mm-hmm. He used to say things like, don't ever get a girl pregnant. Don't ever get married. You know, don't this, don't that. When he'd say these things, I didn't know what to take from it. So I would create my own universe. Mm-hmm. And my sister's like that. A lot of my friends are like that, the ones that I still have, you know, early musicians and things like that. Creating your own universe is the key to it, I believe, you know, and letting all the people that that you need occupy that universe.
To your friends that you referenced a moment ago, how have you chosen, how have you decided to maintain the friendships that you have maintained over the years, and what's your barometer for knowing whether or not those friendships are beneficial? Does that make sense?
Yeah. You can tell whether they're beneficial if someone's respectful of you. Mm-hmm. You know, respectful of you when they're not around you. I find that most people are pretty respectful in front of my face. When they're not around me, sometimes you hear them say some pretty hurtful things. And I don't know if they think it won't get back to me or if I don't care or if I think I'm above it or whatever, but I remember them as I remember them. And we were in love then, we should be in love now. It's a hurtful place, the world in and of itself. We don't need to add to it. Mm-hmm. And we're in a place now where we all need one another and it's gonna get rougher. So I kinda hope that, I hope people, when they hear that, they don't think that I'm going to lash back out at them, because I'm not like that. I've never done that. I've heard a lot of things from a lot of different people, a lot of pretty famous people, a lot of journalists. A lot of my work is judged based upon my personality or my past work as opposed to where we are now. And it is hurtful sometimes.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. And now our tribute to the musical legend Prince, who died unexpectedly on April 21st, concludes.
How do you contextualize emotionally having much of your work judged by your personality rather than on the merits of the work?
Well, one reason is because I like criticism. I like constructive criticism from smart people. I'm thankful enough to, or blessed enough to be able to say that Miles Davis was a friend when he was alive. And he was a wonderful mentor and really, really funny, you know. And he could critique something you've done by humor. You know, and out of love, rather than just, you know, just call you a punk and just say, you know, just dismiss you. he wasn't like that, you know, because people he cared about, you know, he tried to help. When people criticize my work and attack my personality, it's doesn't help me. I can't do anything with it. And I don't know what they, you know, I don't know what they want. I've asked writers this before, and a lot of times they tell me that they just write for each other. They're not really writing for, you know. Well, I really got him that time, didn't I? Okay, well, I don't know. Nobody learns anything from it.
Who's qualified to critique you?
Oh, anybody.
Music critics? Fans? Other artists?
Yeah, I don't mind critiquing anybody. If they do it with a sense of love, if they're trying to, you know, show me something about the work that, you know, they really feel is important for me to know. And I don't see a lot of that in journalism today. Most journalists are just lazy.
Yeah.
You know? It's
like, but if you said you like being critiqued and you love constructive criticism from smart people, how do people critique you if you are so ahead of your time, as you have proven to be consistently? If you're so ahead of your time, how can they critique what they ain't even caught up to?
Because they, listen, if they don't feel what I'm doing, they're going to let me know. If it's somebody I love, they're going to tell me they don't feel it. And they'll tell me the reasons why. And I can appreciate that. You know, I write all the time. I record all the time.
I want to go back to Jack Johnson because he's still in the back of my head. I can't get him out of my head where this conversation is concerned. Who have you felt most often like in the ring fighting the record industry? Like Jack or the opponent?
Oh, like Jack.
Like Jack?
Yeah.
Tell me why.
Well, because I knew I was right. You know, we talked about this in our very first interview and conversation together. It's obvious now that artists are supposed to own their master recordings. I mean, in the future, it'll be unconscionable to even think you can take somebody's creation and claim ownership of it. See, unfortunately, this discussion is going to start to barrel into a discussion about the human genome and the DNA and all the rest of it. When it gets there, then we're going to be in the deep water. See, so it's better to start the conversation now before we get into God talk, you know?
There are songs that I want to ask you about. And I did what I have never done before, which is to actually print these lyrics out. Some of them, I'm since the record is so new, I'm learning some of them. I got some of them memorized.
Who gave you the lyrics, though? I've seen some really strange rewrites of my stuff. Well, I've seen one time they said the lyrics to When Doves Cry was, dig if you will the picture of me, Marvin Gaye, and the kids.
Yeah.
Well, you know what?
And then there was another one. This person will go unnamed.
Yes.
She didn't speak the English language too good.
Right.
She had a really cute daughter, so that's why we was acquaintances.
Yeah.
But she swore up and down, little red Corvette, was pay the rent, collect.
Yeah. Depending on one's perspective, you are either a genius for doing stuff like this, doing it yourself, distributing it yourself, et cetera, et cetera. You're either a genius or you are a hater of the industry, a hater of the way things have been done, ought to be done. Tell me the strategy behind your doing what you do these days.
Well, first of all, there's no hate involved. I mean, I welcome the industry to stay and remain the way it is. I mean, it's actually good because, you know, when I'm sitting talking with somebody like Anita Baker, we can point to the industry as the way we don't want to do it anymore. Mm-hmm. We don't believe in free goods, and we don't believe in, you know, 90% of the contract the way it's written now, the standard contract. We don't believe in 360 deals. Anybody that signs one of those are absolutely crazy. But it's a free country. You can do whatever you want. Mm-hmm. The thinking behind this was to introduce a new artist to the world, somebody who is very dear to me, and her music, it's soothing. It soothes me. I'm not a big fan of male vocalists, you know. Usually when I do ballads, I use my higher register because I love the female voice doing slow music. I spoke too soon and mistakenly compared Bria's music to Sade's music. I didn't mean that she sounded like Sade, but I did mean that there's a romance that is present in Sade's music that, like the song Love is Stronger Than Pride. It's one of the most beautiful tunes ever. And there's a romance that was missing in today's music. And the best thing I could tell Bria was, try to do something that is not happening today. Try to get into a niche, because you have a beautiful voice, but you've got to do something with it that you don't hear. And that's what she's done. And it's one of those sleeper records that, you know, if people play and listen to all the way through, she got you.
Why am I not hearing a lot of this on radio?
I think it's because I'm not signed with a major label. Target is not a record company. They're a distributor and a retail store, and a very good one at that. 30 million people go through their stores every week. So they get a chance to pick up the Lotus Flower record. The beautiful thing about the relationship is that they're treating us like any other record company. They buy the same amount and they pay the same price. So, you know, we've done quite well already.
If you had a station or a string of stations that you were the program director of, owner and program director, what would it sound like?
I would just want it to be good music. Mm-hmm. And I'd want it to be littered with artists who own their master rights, because without that, they don't own any wealth. They can't put back into their community. There's very few artists that do own their masters right now. When that changes in the future, you'll see more radio stations being purchased. You'll see airwaves changing ownership rapidly.
Because you obviously are, you told a Jimi Hendrix story earlier, and because obviously you are the greatest, one of the greatest guitarists of our time.
Man, I like this show.
No, what do you mean? You know why? We just tell the truth around here. We just tell the truth. I'm just trying to be a truth teller. What do you make of this Guitar Hero?
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, I'm mad at him. I hear it made like $2 billion, and they came to us and offered us a very small portion of that. But I just think it's more important that kids learn how to actually play the guitar. It's a tough instrument. It's not easy. It took me a long time, and it was frustrating at first. And you just have to stick with it. And it's cool for people who don't have time to learn the chords or ain't interested in it, but to play music is one of the greatest things. To create something from nothing is one of the greatest feelings, and I wish it upon everybody. It's heaven.
Yeah. She's one of the three records, Elixir, by Bria Valente, in this new 3-CD package at lotusflower.com. Tell me how you found her.
She says that she met me first, and that's what she told me. I say that I met her first. I will say this, that Morris Hayes is very instrumental. He's my keyboard player. He's very instrumental in us actually coming together. Mm. And once we got together, we clicked. It was pretty easy. And the most interesting thing about her is how rapidly she picked up understanding of Scripture. Mm. Because I pretty much talk about that with everybody I know, because it informs my life so much now. The other thing is that she's really funny, and she likes to laugh. And you know, Travis, I love to laugh. So no, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. So.
Yeah, he's funny. Yeah.
I'm kidding. I told her I was going to say that to you one time. That was for her.
You got it out. And on that note, you can get out of here. His name is Prince. His new project is called Lotus Flower. Prince, I love you, and there ain't nothing you can do about it. Glad
love
to have you
back,
here.
Brother.
Appreciate it.
You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel N.C. Abwadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.